Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Gone Medieval from History Hit. I'm Dr. Kat Jarman and I'm very happy that you have joined me for this episode. Today we're going to go quite far away from England and Western Europe to talk about some of the extensive trading networks that thrived during the early Middle Ages. Globalisation is a bit of a buzzword today and often seen as a very recent invention, but you could argue that this was something that really started to emerge in the first millennium. Because this was a time when goods, people and ideas really started to travel quite rapidly across vast distances, bringing things like silk from Asia to England and silver from the Middle East to Scandinavia, while things like furs, amber and slaves travelled south. And in today's episode, we're going to focus on some of the areas further south, East Africa and the Indian Ocean to be precise. And we're going to talk about how this part of Africa was actually very well connected with the wider world. And for most of us, the exploitation of Africa, both for the enslavement of its people and its valuable resources in the very sort of modern period, is very well known. But that more recent slave trade was definitely not the start of it. And if we go back to the early medieval period, something really quite similar took place on the East African coast. So my guest today knows a lot about all of this, and I'm very delighted to welcome Mark Horton, who is a Professor of Archaeology at the newly formed Cultural Heritage Institute, which is part of the Royal Agricultural University. Mark has led research projects in different parts of East Africa for over 40 years, including extensive excavations on the islands off the East African coast, like Zanzibar, Pemba and Madagascar. And one of his main research interests is precisely these wider global connections that emerge in the early medieval period. And for a bit of disclosure here, I should mention that Mark and I normally collaborate on projects looking at that exact time period, but in much colder and rainier conditions in England. But those two are actually really quite connected, as we're going to be talking a bit more about later on. But I thought we could start a little bit, Mark, by talking about these resources. So I just mentioned trade, things coming out of Africa. What sort of things, what sort of objects and resources are we talking about here? What was there in this part of Africa that was so desirable for traders? And where in the world do these goods end up?
Well, in East Africa, the sort of a classic triad of commodities, which is slaves, gold and ivory. And the three commodities, the ones that largely form the basis of most historians' discussions about how the eastern coast of Africa was exploited, really over up to 2,000 years ago. The first ivory trade, for example, is mentioned in a classical document known as the Periplus at the Ithranian Sea. And that describes this elephant ivory that's coming out. And then later on, we've certainly got gold trade, which is known, for example, associated with Great Zimbabwe, but actually is much older. And a slave trade that certainly goes back to the 7th century AD, or maybe even earlier. So the sort of the classic triad of commodities. But alongside those is a long list of other things, more exotic things, that also came out of the region. So, for example, we have ambergris, which is a sort of waxy substance that gets exhaled out of Wales, which is used as a fixative for perfumes. And because of the current system in East Africa, a lot of this washes up on beaches and was prized all the way through the Middle Ages. We have a civet musk. We have leopard skins. We have timber. The Middle East, for example, had very little local wood. And so there was a massive trade in not only high quality teaks, but also mangrove poles, which were used as roofing materials really up until very recently. The mangrove pole trade continued until the 1990s, supplying scaffolding in the Emirates and the Gulf states until steel replaced it. So these trade routes, these trade commodities have a very long history. And I suppose I could say, why did it happen? Well, the key factor are the monsoon winds that blow in one direction for 6 months of the year and then reverse direction in the following 6 months, which enable ships to follow the monsoon, arrive in East Africa, await the change of monsoon, and then sail back with their dhows full of these commodities.
So really, geography is a huge part of this then as well, then, isn't it? That coastline. And in terms of East Africa and these countries that you've talked about so far, what is it there about this and the islands that's so important for the trade to really emerge?
Well, the islands were often places where these trade interactions happened. We think partly because islands provided good anchorages. If you can imagine, you've got a monsoon wind blowing in, you've got a fringing coastal reef, whereas in islands, you can sneak around the back and anchor more safely. But also, it provided a certain safety from the mainland. Mainland Africa was quite a savage place. We know we have a lot of pastoral groups along certain sections of the coastline who tended to be quite warlike in their activities. And I think the traders found it much more convenient to come to these island locations where they could find peace and security.
So this was a sort of safe place to wait out the right time of year to continue trading. And is that where you also start seeing trading settlements springing up?
Yeah, so there's a very interesting, as it were, historiography behind all this, because in the past, earlier colonial historians would see these places as Arab settlements. They would see these as places where the Arabs came from the Gulf region, or maybe Indians from the subcontinent, and they would come here. And, you know, while they're waiting the change of monsoon, would take local wives and produce kind of a miscegenated sort of half Arab, half African population. Our recent archaeological work over the last 40 years has shown that this is actually not the case. That these communities that develop on the islands are essentially Bantu speaking, farming, fishing communities that move out onto the islands and happen to be in the right place to interact with these long distance trade networks. And themselves, they had boats that themselves traded with, and there's some evidence that actually they themselves were also sailing to Arabia and to the Middle East with their commodities.
So we're talking about now the early medieval period. Now, you've mentioned that these objects have been traded for a very long time, so things like the ivory, for example. But what is it really that changes? I think a lot of these changes take place around 700 or so, don't they, in terms of the types of sites that you've worked on and excavated and the scale. What is it that happens, and why at that particular point in time?
Well, we begin to see trade redeveloping from, as you rightly say, about 700, and we can begin to see small quantities of imports turning up in these local indigenous settlements. But really the big takeoff is around 750. And this is really interesting because this is the point at which the Abbasid dynasty comes into power, displaces the Umayyads, and the Abbasids move the headquarters, the focus of the dynasty, away from the Mediterranean and Damascus to the Middle East with their capital in Baghdad. And so suddenly there's this sort of world power out there facing out towards the Indian Ocean. And in this period, around 750, there's an explosion in Indian Ocean trade as this massive consuming Islamic power requires all these commodities, requires slaves to build up its buildings and its agricultural systems. It needs gold, it needs ivory. So there's a huge boom time in the Indian Ocean from around 750 to around 1000. And it's probably driven by the Abbasids and the satellite organized states that surround it.
So in terms of sources for all of this, now obviously you've been working on the archaeological material, but we don't actually have a lot of knowledge from written sources from the West until the first European contact, which I believe is right about the 15th century or so. But the islands and the coast and the people were well described in literature from elsewhere. So can you tell us a little bit about those sources, those other written sources that we have for what's happening in East Africa?
The written sources are slightly beguiling. They are quite extensive. They're written mostly in Arabic. We've got Persian sources. And ironically, we've also got quite a lot of Chinese sources as well. They all have their difficulties in interpretation and they're somewhat fragmentary. Actually, we only have one eyewitness account in this period who actually comes to East Africa. All the rest are secondhand and slightly salacious. They quite like to dwell on the cannibalistic habits of the East Africans and all this kind of stuff. The one person who is actually accurate is a man called Al-Mazudi, who wrote this massive encyclopedia of world history and world geography. And he comes to East Africa. His last voyage is in 916. And he describes from first hand what the places look like, who the rulers are, the fact that they're Muslims and so forth. And so his account is by far the most reliable for this period.
And does he talk about the slave trade or does he talk about the goods or what sort of things does he describe in the account?
So rather curiously, Mazudi makes only the slightest reference to gold. He makes virtually no reference to a slave trade, but he spends his time dwelling extensively on the ivory trade. And he goes to an island called Kambalu, which we think is Pemba Island. But then he also records where the ivory is coming from, not on the coast of East Africa immediately opposite Pemba Island, but way down south in the Mozambique Channel, where there is apparently a massive network of ivory trading going into the far South African interior.
So that's a really great way of showing those wider connections. And interestingly, for those who might be a bit more interested in the Viking Age and the Vikings, we have come across Al-Mazudi before because he also travels extensively into the parts of Eastern Europe where the Vikings settled and travelled right about the same time. So we get these incredible connections between North and South, which we'll get back to a bit again in a moment. But let's get back to the slave trade then. So what other sources of knowledge do we have them? Is there anything in the archaeology that can tell us about it or anything about the scale of the slave trade?
Well, the slave trade is interesting because we know that East African slaves are known as Zanj slaves. Zanj is the Arabic name for this region. And there was a massive revolt of the Zanj slaves in the early part of the 9th century, which practically brought the Abbasid Caliphate to an end, actually. Now, there's a lot of argument about whether the Zanj slaves really came from East Africa or not. But the archaeological evidence suggests that they must have done. We have enormous sites which are full of exotic and expensive trade items, not complex architecture, no stone buildings, but on the other hand, extensive areas of occupation and middens, timber buildings. And to me, the only justification for these enormous sites is that they were massive slave trading corrals and settlements where the Zanj slaves were then taken and shipped to the Middle East.
We don't see anything like burials or anything like that in the places where they were destined. Is there any evidence from any new scientific results or anything like that?
Well, not yet. I mean, what we do know is that the population of the mainland opposite seems to have a massive decline at this period, which is quite good evidence for some form of slave trading to me. But also really interesting observation that these island settlements are Islamic, they're Muslims. Although they're indigenous Africans, they are converted into Islam. However, on the mainland, there is no trace of Islam, apart from the settlements that are right on the beach. There's not a single mosque before the 19th century, which is more than 100 yards from a beach or estuary. Islam didn't penetrate inland. And one reason for that is because you can't enslave Muslims. And so maybe Islam was being kept very much to the coast, and the indigenous populations in the interior were to be exploited for slavery.
So actually there was, if you were living in these places, there would have been a benefit to you to convert to Islam because you would be safer, essentially. Is that what the point of that is?
Absolutely. And that's why essentially people become Muslim, are very keen to become Muslim very early on. It's not because they're Arab traders marrying local women, but it's the locals becoming converted to Islam.
And that, I think, is a really important point, which you don't necessarily think about, because we see the slave trade coming out of the Middle East and out of the Caliphate, going north and looking for slaves from northern territories and interacting with the Vikings, presumably for precisely the same reasons, that they need to go outside their own territory to find people that they can legitimately enslave.
Yes, yeah, so the indigenous, these Muslim communities, have to reinforce their Muslim identity. One thing they do very interestingly is mint their own silver coins. These are minuscule little silver coins that are probably from melted dirhams. Those are the silver coins that you find up in the Viking North. But in this case, they're melted down and turned into these tiny coins that weigh, you know, half a gram, if that. But on there, they strike their name on the one side and a Quranic epithet on the other, so that they're saying that these people, they are converted Muslims, and these coins are the symbol of it.
And that's a local East African invention, because that's something that we don't really see so much elsewhere at that time, is there?
That's right. And the right of coinage, of making coins, was heavily controlled in the Caliphate. You couldn't go off minting your own coins. And so the fact that they are minting their own coins is a massive statement of their political independence, but their adherence to Islam.
Catastrophic warfare, bloody revolutions, and violent ideological battles. I'm James Rogers, and over on the Warfare Podcast, we're exploring the vast history of ferocious global conflict. We've got the classics.
Understandably, when we see it from hindsight, the great revelation in Potsdam was really Stalin saying, yeah, tell me something I don't know.
The unexpected.
And it was at that moment that he just handed her all these documents that he'd discovered sewn into the cushion of the armchair.
And the never ending.
So arguably, every state that has tested nuclear weapons has created some sort of effect to local communities.
Subscribe to Warfare from History Hit wherever you get your podcasts. Join us on the front line of military history.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Okay, so this is a lot about the slaves that are going out of East Africa. What about some of these other resources? We talked about ivory, for example, earlier on. What else can you say about those commodities?
So ivory is really interesting because Al-Mazudi suggests it's coming from the south. And in fact, this is remarkably confirmed by the archaeological evidence. Because increasingly, what's called Iron Age archaeology, this is the Bantu archaeology of southern Africa, these sites have significant numbers of glass beads. Now, these glass beads and also some stone beads as well, you get a few carnelian beads, but principally glass beads, which are being made, we think, either in the Middle East or in India. And we've done extensive science on the beads to work out its elemental content. So we can work exactly where the glass from these beads comes from. And it's quite clear that there's an extensive bead trade from the coast. And in fact, we've found the site where much of this must be coming from, a place known as Shibuen, which was sort of the main entrepot out of which these commodities from South Africa were coming. And these beads extended all the way across South Africa, Zimbabwe, and even into Botswana, 700-800 kilometres inland, and must be being exchanged both amongst the agricultural communities, but also amongst the hunter-gatherers, because it's the hunter-gatherers, what we now call the Khoikhoi or Bushmen, the hunter-gatherers who are probably hunting the elephants.
Right, so you have this direct connection really, really far inland. So the networks essentially allow these goods to come out, and it's the beads that are coming in return, because obviously for that trade to function, there's got to be something pretty valuable for the hunters.
Well, it may well be that it's not exclusive. Beads might just be what we see archaeologically. And of course, they're very light and they can trade and move over huge distances. So they're kind of, if you like, the smoking gun of this trade. And my guess is that that's most likely to have been textiles. Textiles are extremely valuable in African societies. The technology at that point wasn't present. And so you can see how valuable those textiles must have been. And of course, they decay. So there's a constant demand for textiles as they break down, they get rotten and so forth. I mean, a textile probably lasts 5 years or whatever in an African climate. So there's a continuous demand for this material. And I'm sure that's what's fueling this long distance trade.
That's really interesting, because that's something archaeologically that we just wouldn't find any traces of in that sort of climate.
And of course, it may be part of a quite complex network, because textiles are probably being made in India, well, in the Middle East. So somehow the textiles are coming via the Middle East or coming directly to East Africa. There's a really complicated, almost triangular trade route crisscrossing the Indian Ocean, producing these commodities.
So that's quite interesting. So we're talking about India and thinking more about the further east of that network. I wonder if we can just move in that direction a little bit. So we've talked a lot about the connections to the Middle East, but what about Asia, and what about, you know, places like China? Is there any evidence that there's contact between China and India and then down to East Africa at the time?
Well, one of the big mysteries still largely unresolved in Indian Ocean history is Madagascar. So Madagascar is still populated and by people who speak a language which is very closely akin to languages spoken in Borneo, which is in Southeast Asia, part of what's called the Bariti group of languages. And so both linguistic and now the DNA evidence strongly suggests that Madagascar was settled partly from East Africa, but also largely from Southeast Asia. So one of the great mysteries is, how did this happen? And the suggestion is that actually this is part of a long-distance trade network that follows the sort of more equatorial route or sub-equatorial route from Southeast Asia directly to Madagascar. And so when you're into that network, you're then rapidly into the South China Sea and into China. So we know from our sites, dating from 800 or thereabouts, significant quantities of Chinese ceramics mixed in with the Islamic ceramics, mixed in with the local ceramics. So there clearly were these connections. The traditional interpretation is that Arab ships were sailing to China and bringing back these Chinese ceramics or then being traded to East Africa. But it's equally possible that these trade links were directly with Southeast Asia and there onwards to China.
That's really interesting. And are there any shipwrecks or anything like that that can tell us a bit more about that?
Well, extraordinarily, there is. Near the Sunda Straits, which is the way in which you would pass between Java and Sumatra, there was a very famous shipwreck dating to around 830 called the Belatung shipwreck. This was excavated by commercial treasure hunters a few years ago, but the collection has all been kept together, and there were quite good investigations of the hull structure itself. The Belatung ship was full of 40,000 vessels of Chinese, what's called Changsha stoneware, which is exactly the type of painted stoneware we find in the Comores, for example, and all along the trading towns of the East African coast at this period. The Belatung ship was actually made from timber from East Africa. So was it a ship built in East Africa? Was it a ship built in the Middle East out of African timber that had been traded up there? Was it making for the East African coast, or was it off course doing a much more traditional route directly to the Middle East? But the Belatung is a really interesting example of a ship that's clearly connected into this trade network.
That's a fantastic example that really is like a manifestation of all those connections. How about other ships? Are there any others about specific commodities?
Well, actually, only a few hundred miles away from the Belatung ship, there's another ship called the Sirabon ship. So this is an Indonesian ship made out of what's called lash lug construction. So it's definitely not a sewn boat like the Belatung shipwreck is. And the Sirabon ship was twice the size. Twice the length, four times the size of the Belatung. It was probably 35 metres in length. So this is longer than, for example, Columbus's ships, if you put it into perspective. And this was filled with 400,000 Chinese vessels, believe it or not, but also vast quantities of rock crystal. Now, rock crystal is really interesting because this is coming out of Madagascar. And we've been excavating sites on the Comores that are essentially processing this rock crystal trade in the 8th century, and is then being sent both to the Abbasid world of the Middle East and then later on into the Fatimid world of the Mediterranean. Huge lumps of completely pure rock crystal. But this Sirabon ship had these lumps. One of them was half a ton in size of rock crystal that was coming from Madagascar.
That's some quite staggering quantities you're talking about. Half a ton of rock crystal and, what is it, 400,000 vessels. That's madness. But it shows that this isn't a sort of small-scale little cottage industry. This is trade on a massive scale. And when you talk about rock crystal, I have to, of course, make the connections back up to the north again, because we know that exactly the same time, so many of these commodities make their way very far up north, up to northern Europe, and are especially prized by the Vikings. And we see a lot of rock crystal, which may well be, we don't know yet, but we think that may come from the same sources. So So you're sort of seeing two different parts of the network here. Can you say a little bit more about how this extends back up to Europe at that time?
Well, yes, absolutely, because all this East African material is being funneled into the Gulf and is being funneled into Baghdad and all the great Abbasid cities, which, of course, are the trading points for the Vikings coming from the north. And so it's not a difficult jump to see. We've got the ships, we've got the historical records, we have the archaeology that clearly shows how these high-value precious items are coming from tens of thousands of miles away, are coming up into the Gulf, being funneled into the Abbasid cities. And then you can tell me how that material is then connected equally well through the Russian rivers up into the Baltic world and beyond.
Yeah, precisely. So this is where it sort of comes into this whole idea of globalization, isn't it? That's similar to more modern concepts, because we have the networks and some of those are pre-existing and some of them are being developed at precisely this time, starting in about the 8th century. And it does seem to me very much like what's happening in the Middle East is a really key and crucial connector between North and South and East and West.
Yeah, and Kat, the problem that scholars we've always had in this is that we have the people working in the Viking world and they just about understand a bit about what's going on in Islam, but certainly not anywhere beyond. And then we then have the scholars working in the Islamic world who have a vague recollection of the Viking world and the African world. And then we have people working down in Africa who have a sort of understanding, but actually connecting these enormous, mind-boggling trade routes and connections is kind of, you know, beyond the sort of scholarly mind set at the moment.
Absolutely. So I think we need more ambitious projects, wouldn't you say?
That's right. Indeed we do. And, you know, it's science. It's ultimately it's science that's going to help us tell these things. So, for example, you mentioned rock crystal. We need to find a method to be able to provenance rock crystal. I mean, at present, there isn't one because by definition, it's very pure silicate, a silicate crystal. So to actually find trace elements and things, it is very, very difficult. So we need to find ways to characterize and to provenance this material, to do the ancient DNA on the human remains, and to really bring the science to bear to understand these global connections.
Okay, so to summarize a little bit then, let's talk a little bit about just who the people were that were involved in this. And it's easy to see it as a very much an external thing that is just happening, and the locals are very passive in that. Is that an accurate reflection, or what's sort of happening internally, and who is involved in everything in this trade?
It's quite clear that the coastal communities in East Africa are actually the people who are in control of the trade. I mean, think of it, you know, you're a ship coming in from the Middle East. And in fact, we've got a contemporary illustration that shows that there's a ship captain and we've got a whole series of merchants who are on board the ship who are basically undertaking the trade. So the ship arrives into these ports and the merchants are kind of left on their own. They go ashore and ultimately they have to trade with their partners in these ports. And literally, the merchants are kind of dumped on the beach, powerless, have no military support, they have nothing. They're out there with a trunk load of textiles and precious items, and they want to get buy ivory or whatever. And so essentially, they're completely at the mercy of the local inhabitants. So they have to try strike up trade links with the local merchants, who are obviously quite keen to do so because they want all these goodies that are coming from the Middle East. And we know traditionally that the sort of hospitality that ultimately the locals sponsor these merchants. So an individual merchant would move into a particular merchant's house, local merchant's house, who would be fed and watered and looked after during the change of monsoon. But that merchant could only trade with the local person. So there's a monopoly going on. And in exchange, the locals acquired commodities, but themselves became more and more urbanized, more and more Islamicized. They started building stone houses rather than mud and wattle houses. They became much more sophisticated. and essentially assimilating a lot of the ideas of their traders in very much the same way as going on the Viking world. That it wasn't, I believe, a set of rape and pillage, but there's a second phase of connections between the Vikings, the Irish, or the Vikings and the Anglo-Saxons that was a much more two-way process.
Yeah, so it's sort of connecting, taking advantage of the conditions that they come across and actually using that very much to people's advantage.
That's right. Exploiting to making the best of the situation. Because on these voyages, millions could be made in modern terms. You know, they were very dangerous voyages. But if you undertook a successful half dozen or so, you would be a multimillionaire in modern terms. So the rewards were enormous. But they had to be done very much in private free enterprise.
So we're talking about entrepreneurs, really, if we're going to use another modern term in many ways.
That's right. Global entrepreneurs. That's exactly who these merchants are.
Fantastic. So I think we can see quite clearly how this early medieval period had just a tremendous impact on shaping what East Africa was to become and what we see if we travel there today. So, I mean, what would you say would be the most crucial part or the sort of crucial legacy, I guess, from that period?
Well, I mean, you know, the 300 ruined cities, for example, most of which are covered in bush. You know, there's massive quantities of ruins. I mean, if you're going to visit, then some of this culture still very much survives today. Places like Lamu, for example, in the Lamu Archipelago in Kenya, or Zanzibar, or down in the Comores, or in Madagascar, elements of this entrepreneurial culture, this Swahili culture, as we call it, still survives to this day.
Wonderful. Mark, thank you so much for joining me today. It was a real pleasure talking about the other ends of these networks that we normally investigate when we work together. I'm wondering if I sort of drew the short straw in terms of climate when choosing my research location, so I'll have to come along next time. So this brings us to the end of this episode. Thank you all for listening. Please do remember to subscribe to Gone Medieval if you haven't already. And if you enjoyed this episode, please do leave us a review online and tell all your friends and family about it. I'm Dr. Kat Jarman, and this has been Gone Medieval from History Hit. Do join us again next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Gone Medieval. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us out and you'll be doing me a big favour. Don't forget you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use the code MEDIEVAL at checkout.